Sure. Yeah.
Am I supposed to wait for that thing?
Yeah. You can. I can hear you.
That's great. On Friday, on Friday, Jeff talked about, and he just talked about the increase in R&D spending of anywhere between $200 and $500 million.
Yeah.
Can you give us a sense for where the bulk of that is within that chart that you just described, and also how is that going to be paid for in the near term? So in other words, is this all just additional expense, no real change in the profit structure of the business in the near term, and therefore we should just count on this for, you know, as you said, future growth past the
Here's the way I would look at it. You know, you saw the portfolio we showed you today of exactly where our positioning is today. And with that, as we come out of this, last 2 years and start a recovery, you should see an increase in the spare parts that is consistent with the overhaul that I showed you. You know, you saw those overhaul growth. So you've got lift associated with the services side of our business just based on our current portfolio of technologies. Now, we have to decide, in addition to that lift, how much investment we want to make sure that we secure that same portfolio look going out into the next decade. Right now, we've made commitments on LeapX. So, you know, for example, we're running E-Core. We've run two builds of the E-Core already. The second build was run the first half of this year, and now is torn down for us to not only analyze the data, but we're doing the third redesign on the airfoils to get more efficiencies, and we'll have it back on test next year, which is the backbone of LeapX. That is also the backbone that scales down to the regionals and to the business general aviation. So think about E-Core as being the centerpiece of those investments. We also have a technology suite for the next generation of the GE9115B that we have to start developing now, because that actually comes beyond LeapX. And so there are some technology. We have a few inventions that we have to schedule on the GE9X, and we have to start that investment in 2011 and beyond. And I mean material, from a material perspective, some of the materials and aerodynamics in that engine are going to require us to work on them pretty hard for the kind of efficiencies we want. Now, we feel comfortable. We've got a path, but we have to start that investment for that generation of engines starting in 2011 also. So that's where the majority of that's going to be. Now, in addition to that, in the joint venture, since the C919 goes into service in 2016, think about a world where we're now starting to invest in the avionics suite for the C919 so that we can have that first flight in 2014 and ready to go into revenue service by 2016, both in terms of the engines, the nacelles and thrust reversers, and the avionics work on it. Okay? Well, you know, I'm not going to give you any forward-looking statements one way or the other, but the trade is you've got lift in the aftermarket and investment in the next generation of the portfolio, and depending on the trajectory of those two depends on what happens as we go forward. Okay?
Steve, maybe you could talk about some of the other big pieces over the next couple of years. 787 losses is one thing that's on a number of people's minds. I talk about any of the other big moving pieces beyond R&D we should be thinking about.
No, you know, I think about the level of technology we brought to the marketplace with the GNX, right? So you're talking about an engine that, compared to the 767 at Azerbaijan we just talked about, is 15 to 18% better in fuel efficiency. It has a set of technologies in that engine that are unique in the world. It literally will be the most advanced jet engine in the world when it goes into service next year. With that set of technologies now, as we productionize and learn how to manufacture, you can imagine on a learning curve, we're on the high end of a learning curve of some very, very advanced technologies. Now, that learning curve drives itself to entitlement based on how productive we can be, and you need volume to get that productivity fast. So I'm really happy with the position in the order book and the volume that GNX is going to go through, because it'll accelerate the learning curve that is natural to these new technologies and also create that generation that has to go into LEAP by 2016 and the other products. So that's kind of the way to think about where we are on the GNX, is certainly the new technologies have to be productionized. The volume allows us to accelerate the productivity of that because we've got a good order book. I'll tell you, if you lived through the GE90 and the 777, this is a kind of a deja vu all over again if you're Yogi Berra. So we get it. We understand what it means when you make these kind of investments, and this is part of the phase of the program you plan for, just like you would plan for any other phase in development. And so we're entering a phase now where we have to get down the learning curve and learn how to get the entitlement into these brand-new sets of technologies consistent with the current CFM and CF6 products that we have today.
I mean, I think it all makes sense. Obviously, you've got a great long-term opportunity. But, I mean, is there actually a chance you can keep profit flat in the near term and still capture that longer-term opportunity? I mean, you're running down 10% year-over-year in the first half. I think that kind of looks like the trajectory for the second half. I mean, trading, you know, a little down profit in 11 for a lot of long-term opportunity seems reasonable, you know, from the company's overall perspective. But, I mean, how do you...
Yeah.
You want us to walk out of here thinking there's no degradation in profit in 11? Is that the message you want us to take?
No, I don't. I don't want to give you any forward projections of where we're going to be. But I do want you to think of a business that's faced with this decision of whether the portfolio strength that we have today needs to, how do we maintain that moving forward, right? Now, you have an example of an engine guy who didn't do that right now. And you know how hard they're working to get back into this business right now, right? I can tell you that's the last place GE wants to be over the next 5 to 8 years, is to take the current portfolio position and make it the last chapter of the GE Aviation portfolio position in the next generation, okay? And that's kind of the way I would think about it, because it certainly is what keeps me up at night.
Maybe within GECAS, what are you hearing from your customers, your airline customers, on the re-engineering of the narrow bodies? And secondly, how does an Airbus and Boeing re-engineering impact the R&D outlook in 2011, 2012?
Sure. Look, the OEMs are still working on what they want to do, so it might be a little bit early phase, but Airbus seems to be a little bit further along. And I think if you're, let me just sort of hypothesize a little bit from an airline operator standpoint. If you're an existing operator, 320s, CFM, you'll like the fuel burn efficiency, you'll like the commonality with the frame, you'll like the existing product support. You'll like the product support infrastructure of CFM. So it could be, depending upon whether they do something a compelling proposition to look at on the Airbus and Boeing. It's too early to really talk about. Maybe it's a question for later in the year. And in terms of the other question, maybe it's more David's, the second question.
Which, just repeat it for me.
Yeah, so how does that impact your, I mean, you gave a framework for the R&D in 2011, 2012. To what extent is that contingent on, Airbus and Boeing?
Yeah. Well, because we've launched that LeapX on the C919, I look at the launch of LeapX as the best risk reduction for Boeing and Airbus they've got, because they guarantee I'm going to make the investments and the technologies on the engine, and they have the freedom now to make the decision they need to make in the time frame they need to make, knowing full well they can plug my engine technology underneath that wing or on a new airplane, depending on what they want to do. So for me, it's really kind of transparent. I've made the commitment. We're going to run the E-Core. We're going to create that suite of technologies. It's beyond their re-engineering. It gives me the C919 application and then sets me up for the next generation regional and business and general aviation airplanes. And so I'm going to go ahead and drive that suite of technologies into a suite of products and make them available in the marketplace than anyone that has either a new airplane or a new re-engineering opportunity that the business case closes for us. Okay?
And then just quickly on the A350 second engine, the discussions, are they dead or?
No, here's the position's pretty much the same as it was last year, and it really, the math kind of boils down to this. The A350 is a wonderful airplane, and it's larger than the 787. The 900, which is the flagship for that product family, is really a 777-200ER. So the engine for me to power that would be unique versus the GEnx. I would have to start spending money on a brand new engine program to power the 900. Now, the highest variant of the 350, the 1000, is a direct competitor with the 777-300ER, which I'm sole source. So my first obligation is to sell 300 ERs with GE90s, like Emirates yesterday, taking an incremental 30, right? So I don't want to create a product that competes with my GE90 product, and I don't want to spend all the development on a pinpoint design just on the A350-900 going head-to-head against Rolls-Royce, right, and at best beating the heck out of each other. So I can't make that proposition of value for my board close today. It doesn't mean we're saying no forever, but today I can't make that proposition of value close, okay? And it really is that prescriptive in terms of the evaluation. And we look at it every quarter, okay?
Can you talk as a leasing company to how you view the difference in residual value impact on your fleet, on your existing fleet, in a re-engine and redesign scenario? And the second question is, of the 4,000 maintenance visits
overhauls
you had last year, overhauls in the engine business, can you speak to whether that's CFM and GE? And can you speak to how the CFM revenues are split on that service business and then earnings on that, on
okay,
that business?
Norm, do you want to start?
Sure. On the residual impact, I tried to cover that a little bit through my life cycle chart. But, you know, the thing is still 5-plus years away, so we have some time. I think you have to have enough of these future-gen planes in the marketplace to have an impact on the current gen planes. And when you look at just the large numbers of new current gens that have been produced these past years, and most likely the next 5 years, you're going to have 11,000-12,000 units. So to get the future gens in, you're probably talking to 2023 or beyond to even get to 50%, and probably 2027, just back of the envelope, is when the crossover point would be. So these current gens are here for a long time to stay, as opposed to classics, which peaked about, you know, 2,500. There'll be a residual impact. It'll be dependent upon fuel prices, and it'll be dependent upon the price of the option, if you will. And, you know, but that impact is something that's over, you know, over many, many years you have to factor in. Each lessor will make their own assumptions. I think long term. I mean, short term, you know, they'll have a, you know, have a residual impact. I mean, maybe short term it'll help people want to lease the current gen fleet is sort of a hypothesis of some. But I think longer term, the fact that you have commonality in such a large base is probably, you know, a good thing for residual values. Is sort of the way I look at it, just because of the enormity of the existing customer base.
Yeah, and on the if you'll actually take a look at the chart, it breaks out CFM versus GE on the overhauls. The backlog of the services contracts are all GE. So the $58 billion backlog I talked about on commercial service contracts is a GE number. That's GE numbers growing to $63 billion in backlog of services. That's a pure GE play. But the number of shop visits is actually busted out in that chart, CFM versus GE. So you can just take a look at it and get them right off of there.
And how does that
same as, you know, in terms of the way CFM works is a pure 50-50 split, you know what I mean? And that is through the life cycle of the engine. So, you know, we have 50-50 responsibility across the board on the CFM. That in terms of production, development, aftermarket, in terms of, and it's based on parts revenue, not on as servicing, but just purely on parts sales, okay? It's a 50-50 split of revenues, and you own your own productivity. So your margins are totally dependent on how much you invest in your own productivity on a base of a revenue line that's cut 50-50.
So when I bring an engine in for an overhaul, will I typically need every piece of that engine overhauled?
No, it depends. You know, it really depends on whether it's the first overhaul, the second, or whatever. But you and I can split off and get into philosophy for overhauling engines depending on how long you want the on-wing time to be. But you can imagine the sophistication of what your ownership horizon is, which is part of this used material play that Norm was talking about, whether it be your first overhaul, and then what we've designed into the engine in terms of its maintainability. So We've designed to minimize your maintenance costs, so at first shop visit, you'll go into certain modules. At second shop visit, you'll go into different modules. You know what I mean? And then at end of life on the fifth shop visit, we'll create products that match the residual value of the asset with what your ownership horizon is with Norm through Gene. So it's a pretty sophisticated, you know, with, like I said, we've been doing this since 74 on the CFM, for example. We've got 500 million flight hours of experience doing it. And so just like the technologies on the new engines grow, our ability to create a pretty sophisticated maintenance program for these guys to create value for the CFM continues just about on the same pace. And it's all about learning, you know. So every overhaul gives us something we've learned about a given component. We may redesign it to get more life out of it, you know. Yeah.
Just following right up on that overhaul comment, other engine makers have talked about during this downturn for airlines conserving cash. They've done somewhat of a lower bill of work or bill of materials on some of those shop visits. And can you just talk about what the current trends have been in terms of those shop visits kind of this year versus last year, maybe 2 years ago, and what they're buying?
Yeah, I think as you've stated, you know, spare parts and service is one of the really interesting markets for me, because when you're headed into a downturn, there's zero lag. Because any overhaul or any expense that's discretionary immediately gets cut to conserve cash, right? So think of a world when you come into one of these cycles to where you feel it like 2 minutes after the cycle starts because of the cash conservation behavior of most airlines. And that will mean when you have engines that have to overhaul for a certain reason, you make the decision of whether you want them to last shorter on wing to conserve cash today. Right, and if so, you change the build standard of the engine, but you pay for it. You know what I mean? Nothing's for free. So if you put more repaired product in the engine at overhaul, it won't stay on wing as long, and you'll end up pulling in the next overhaul, which means you'll have another expense associated with it shorter than you would if you had built to a different standard at that overhaul. That's the trade that's always made. Then on the way out of one of these cycles, you need to have demand for air travel go up. You need to have frequency of the use of the equipment go up. And then finally, you see the services go up. So we lag on the way out 6 to 9 months normally, okay? We don't lag at all going in, right? Which is why the first half of this year, quite frankly, is a reflection of the operating parameters for the last half of 09, more than it is a reflection of the growth we're seeing right now in 2010, you know?
But would you see it in your shop visit plans for the second half of this year already?
Yes.
Would you see people doing the more normal life-limited part replacement,
both,
et cetera?
We're seeing it in the shop visit plans. So people that held off doing shop visits, all of a sudden they're in a rush to get their engines in because there's more demand for those airplanes, right? So as you take things back or you increase capacity, right? So we're seeing more shop visits in the second half of the year, and then we're seeing a return to normalcy in terms of what kind of spend they want on those overhauls so that they get the right work scope based on how long they think they're going to own the equipment. And that's part of the indicators for us to understand where the cycle is. Absolutely.
Thank you. And then, Norm, I just wanted to follow up. You had in your presentation, you said 73% of your, planes are placed in 2011. Can you just put that in perspective? Is that a high number, or low number? Going into
that's
year
typical,
at this point, that's
typical
fairly
number.
Typical.
We don't want to place everything if the market's getting a little bit better. So, and I don't recall the number of units, but it's like, you know, a couple handfuls. So it's not a lot of units for us.
Okay, thank you.
So we feel very comfortable.
Thanks. Good morning. How much of the improved fuel efficiency and reduced maintenance is enabled by engineering and the design, and how much of it do you think comes from some of the new advanced materials? Thanks a lot.
You know, it's a good question. And, you know, I don't have a percentage, but I think of it more as a continuum. In other words, the advanced, let's take a composite fan blade, right? So that material change lightened up fan blades significantly. Which then, if you look at the design of everything that holds that fan blade, all the way down to the frames in the engine, it created a whole different design space for the designers of the engine because they didn't have to carry the weight of a metal fan blade, right? So materials by themselves are only important when they increase the operating environment or they allow the designer more flexibility in the way he designs the engine. So, for example, in the GNX, we have two stages of this very unique material called titanium aluminide. It literally is one-third of the weight of steel, and it's in the low-pressure turbine. And so you can imagine when we look at how that cascades into the engine design, there are many unique features in the GNX that are purely enabled by the fact that those blades are only a third of the weight they would have been if they were steel. And that flows itself into the whole design. So, you know, that's the way to kind of think of how materials and designers work together, right?
Sorry, guys. Is there maneuverability in your relationship with Boeing on if they were to do a re-engine of 737 in terms of the monopoly? Because obviously Airbus is likely to go with a re-engine and with two engines, the geared turbofan and the other. What's the maneuverability from your guys' part?
Well, you know, we're gonna offer the LeapX technology to Airbus and to Boeing. And we're going to let Boeing and Airbus look at their market size and make a decision on whether they want to offer two engines or one. We certainly would like to be CFM and continue in our position with Boeing on the 737 going into a re-engining decision if Boeing makes that decision. We hope the compelling argument for that is the satisfaction of the customers and the level of technology we can bring underneath the wing and the business deal we can strike with them. Right, and if we can match and triangulate on all three of those, then we're going to certainly make that case. But it'll be Boeing's decision at the end of the day based on what they think the total market size is and what the appetite is for the engine and what the business deal is, you know. But if you ask me what my preference is today, you can imagine my answer, right? Now, at Airbus, you know, we know that we're going to be one of two under wing. And so we also are going to work with Airbus just like we would work with Boeing, to bring those LeapX technologies in to a solution for them. And of course that engine will be a different size and it'll have a suite of technologies that make it incredibly competitive underneath that wing so that our share of CFMs on A320s can be maintained versus where we are today.
So you're not in the position where you would plan to push the contract on Boeing on 737 at all?
No, look, that relationship with Boeing is an extraordinary partnership and it's benefited both of us. Both of us will say that. You just take a look at the success of the 7-3. I mean, there are people that literally bolt the engine on, take delivery of it, and they don't even open the cowling for 6 years because of the reliability of that motor. I mean, it's an extraordinary product. It's a workhorse. You look at how Southwest uses those 7-3s or Ryanair. You know, and the same thing's true with Airbus, quite frankly. Look at Ariane or EasyJet. But they're extraordinary products, and we're not about to do anything but bring the best solution to Boeing and let them make the answer when this is all said and done. And we hope we have a compelling case. In fact, we do have a compelling case.
Thanks.
Okay, are we done?
Yep.
All right, so if you have any questions, the vice presidents of each one of the P&Ls are here, as well as my chief marketing officer in the back. Feel free to ask any questions of any of us. And thanks very much for coming. I appreciate it. Thank you.